This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, when you hear people say y'all or bless her heart, you probably know they're from the South. But how about dingbatter, cabbage ruff, or
Cygoglin.
Cygoglin, which I think is an adjective, right?
Yeah.
Walt Wolfram is here, and he's the guy who collects all these words and has been for more than 20 years collecting the sounds of North Carolina speech and dialect. Walt works at NC State. He's been exploring the diversity for two decades. He's a professor of English and director of the North Carolina Language Project. His team has conducted more than 3,000 interviews, and he recently co-authored a book along with Jeffrey Reaser that documents the findings. The book is called Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina. Walt Wolfram, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank. Great to be here.
You have been documenting our dialects and our accents for, as I say, more than 20 years, the various locations all around the state. This book kind of pulls it all together.
Yeah,
right?
It pulls it all together, and it tries to do so in a way that people who aren't linguists, who are simply interested in language differences, can understand what this treasure of language and what the language legacy of North Carolina is.
Well, and I guess one of the hard parts is it is a science. It's a scholarly pursuit. And yet, if I were to ask you what is a dialect, how do you distinguish one dialect from another? That's where it gets kind of squishy, huh?
Well, it does get squishy. And actually, when somebody says, well, how many dialects are there in North Carolina? I said, well, anywhere from 2 to 200. And they say, I thought you were a dialectologist. Yeah, I can tell you what the structures are, but I'm not sure where one dialect stops and another begins. So it does get, there's both great science. We can measure vowels that show incredible small differences. But it also is an art in the sense of when does one dialect become another.
Right. And it's up to our ears. And, of course, one of the great challenges for all of us is pronunciations, particularly when we're talking about other people's parts of the state, right? So you've got sample. And here's one of the great things about the book, by the way, QR codes all throughout that allow us, so you read the book, but you just, you've got a QR code and I can go and listen to the.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about language, it's a lot easier to experience than it is to talk about. So we try to sort of fill it with 125 QRs that video, audio, so you can see the speakers, hear the sounds for yourself. And that makes it come to life.
And here's an example.
Manteo, Viewers Creek.
Ahoski.
Fuqua Varina. Robeson County.
Arokakoke.
Nantahala.
Chickamacamico.
Uari.
Saxapaha.
Is that legal in the state, all that they said? Am I in trouble with the FCC?
Yeah.
What was going on there?
Well, basically, we went to the state fair where we have an annual exhibit, and we asked 200 people, would you read the names of these places in North Carolina? And, of course, locals could read them as they were supposed to sound, and outsiders would read them in a way that was, the best they could do.
Yeah.
But it wasn't local.
We should probably get this out of the way now because we're going to have to talk about the county that I refer to as Robeson.
Yeah.
Because then I either get emails from everybody or nobody.
Right.
There's really no agreement on Robeson.
Well, except that most insiders call it Robeson. And so if you're an announcer, you should continue to get emails, Frank, from people from Robeson County. Say, Frank, don't say Robeson, say Robeson.
See, we tried that, and we called people who lived in Robeson County, and most of them said Robeson.
Yeah.
Many of them who live there said Robeson. Not many.
Must have been outsiders.
They were outside. Well, that brings us to the next question. The effect of outsiders on a place like North Carolina, which has distinct a sound and distinct accents, it's profound, isn't it?
Well, it is profound, and the whole demographics of North Carolina is changing, There's the whole Yankee effect, which affects big cities like Charlotte and Winston-Salem and Greensboro and Raleigh in ways that are changing the nature of regional varieties, but at the same time, keeping them regional in distinctly unique and more sort of subtle ways.
But the people in those places are beginning to notice, as you found when you talked to one longtime resident of Charlotte.
And these Northerners come down here, and we take them in, and before you know it, it ain't the same. It's really not. They don't think and act like we do. Well, they sure don't talk like us. They have a sharpness to their speech, don't you think so?
Yeah.
Most Southerners and all, I mean, I feel like we have kind of a soft melody. Of course, why shouldn't I think it? I don't know any difference.
Martha Pearl Villas, is that from Charlotte?
Yeah, from Charlotte, and she's lived there. As a matter of fact, she lived where Discovery Place is and was part of sort of the upper crust of Charlotte. And, you know, she certainly has a distinct variety that anybody who moves to Charlotte today says, this isn't a charlatan. Oh, yes, it was a charlatan.
Hey, but you said also that the impact is to keep some of the parts of language distinct. Is it not all sort of becoming some kind of, you know, TV speak?
No, because people want to sound like people they hang out with in person, even if they do social media all day. They still want to sound like the people that they associate with. And so peers, cohorts, and so forth. And there's also a new wave of regionalism that people want to be from the South. They want to be from someplace. And dialects allow them to be from someplace.
Well, the question is, if you want to sound like the people you hang out with, then in that case, how does language ever change or dialect?
Well, it's a complicated way in which language changes. You know, part of it is just sort of the structure of language, and part of it is through social forces. People ratify changes. You know, changes are offered. Some people accept them and don't accept them. And it's just a really subtle but fascinating prospect, because language is always dynamic and changing.
Martha talked about this kind of roundabout way of speaking, less direct, less sharp, in the South. How much of dialect and accent is shaped by culture? I mean, if we're talking about a culture in which courtesy and indirect discourse is a cultural norm, versus kind of getting to the point, does that have any impact on dialect?
Well, it does. I mean, there are all these levels of dialect differences. So it's not simply a matter of pronunciation and grammar, but it's also how you greet, how you address people. You know, so this is my aunt. An aunt may die, and a student can't come to class, and then you realize it wasn't really the aunt, but it was just a good friend and so forth. So there are all these levels that make it very subtle.
And then I guess phrases, too. It's not just the dialect, but phrases. I mean, one of the ones that I find most charming down here is the what I call the double conditional.
Yeah.
You might could.
Yeah. And actually, the last three governors of the state have used might could, and they use it in a way that doesn't quite obligate them. So are you coming to the party Saturday night? I might could. You don't have to show up.
Yeah, no, that's perfect political speech.
Yeah.
I thought he said, yes, what do you think? Might could. I don't know.
He said he might could come.
and also ways of which whole forms of speech, again, not just language. I want to listen to this clip that you picked up from a resident of the Outer Banks.
Well, you take a pretty day, you know. You walk out the house, sun's bright and shiny. You say, this is an ugly day, isn't it? What you mean is a pretty day, you know. And she say, well, what's wrong with the day? I said, well, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a pretty day. She said, why don't you say that? It took my wife about 20 years to realize I was talking in opposites.
They could say, that crowd had the greatest time. Well, that could have meant that it could have been anywhere from 2 people to 20 people. The term crowd is used very loosely. In the greatest time, it could be not necessarily positive. It could have been that maybe they were fussing about something and feuding and hollering and screaming and whatever. But I say people in their maybe mid-40s on up, you'll hear a greater amount of these expressions, and especially the older folks.
What's going on there, Walt?
Well, that's talking backwards or talking over the left shoulder. They actually have a term. Which is where words take their opposite meaning in a way that's flouted so that people understand. So if it's a beautiful day out, you say, sure, it's a terrible day, you know. And we do that to some extent, but it's not as refined. So, for example, the term ill now means good among teenagers. So this thing that we call, quote, semantic inversion actually takes place in culture, but it's so refined in these Outer Banks communities that it's a more sort of recognized and ritualistic kind of thing.
Which means that language and dialect really gives us an insight into culture.
Well, I don't see how you can define culture without the integral aspect of language.
But what do you make of it? I mean, then how far can you go as a scholar? What do you make of a cultural norm that embraces this kind of opposite vocabulary?
Well, what we're trying to do is get people to understand it, that this is just as much a part of things North Carolinian and as much to be treasured as, you know, musicians, artists, writers, and so forth. North Carolina has one of the most, and we argue that it's the most diversity of any dialect area in the United States because of the topographical differences and because of the breadth of the state. And what we're trying to do is say, celebrate that along with our musicians, along with our writers. Why not language? It's not a matter, it's not something to be overcome. It's something to be embraced.
Yeah, and the fact is, I mean, obviously language is culture, but when we think we share a common language and it's all English, these fine distinctions are also a window into these kind of geographic distinctions as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Walt, we're going to continue this conversation. Walt Wolfram is the co-author, along with Jeffrey Reeser, of a book called Talkin' Tar Heel, and we'll continue our conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking about dialect diversity with North Carolina State Professor Walt Wolfram, who's been studying the subject for years. He, along with a colleague at NC State, Jeffrey Reeser, have co-authored the book Talkin' Tar Heel, and it summarizes much of the diversity that we experience and have come to appreciate here in North Carolina. And we were talking about the Outer Banks, which, of course, is kind of the most famous.
Right.
That's well-known all over. And we talked about this kind of backwards talking, talk backwards. But things are changing there as well, right, in terms of both dialect, language, and some of the terms they're using.
Well, yeah. I mean, change on the Outer Banks and among the Lumbee is constant. As a matter of fact, we would say that the Outer Banks is now an endangered dialect. Unlike, however, Lumbee English, because there's a much more dense population and concentration and segregation culturally, so that actually Lumbee English is more alive and well than Outer Banks English is today.
Well, there's some evolution going on in the Outer Banks. The very first time we had you on here several years ago, dingbatter was a term that you had to introduce to us, and you
right.
you can reintroduce it and tell us what it means.
Yeah, it actually was derived from the Archie Bunker All in the Family show, where he called his wife a dingbat, and TV came in at that time, and they, oh, this is great. This is exactly how outsiders are. Hey, no common sense, dingbat. But now when we teach the kids in the school, what we find is that they're changing because they didn't watch All in the Family and Dingbatter. And so now they're Turons. That is a blend of a tourist and a moron. Which, so you have your choice. Would you rather be a Turon, a dingbatter, or even a dit-dot? You know, for the Morse code, like dot dot, can't you understand me? We need to send it through Morse code,
which I think is how barbarian got started, right there, to bar 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 bar, and that became barbarian. Yeah. So that makes a lot of sense. You talked about Lumbee community in Robeson County, and let's hear a clip because that's kind of fascinating. That is a distinct, certainly form, and I want to hear this clip.
And we were there on at a research conference in Miami, Florida. And we're out that night, and we kind of take the wrong bus or the wrong subway or something. But we get lost, and we get on a bus. And it's about 7 or 8 of us, I guess, together mm-hmm. on the bus, and the bus driver. And this one guy sitting at the front of the bus with a patch over his eye, and he looks like he's hungover from something. And so we're just, you know, all happy-go-lucky because, you know, we're just having a good time sitting at the back of the bus just talking. And he turns around and just looks at us, and all of us are like this. And he's like, y'all from Robeson County, aren't you?
So they know.
Yeah, they know. They know each other. And actually, we did some tests in which we played speakers, African-American, Lumbee, and white. And people from Lumbee consistently recognized the Lumbee. People from Raleigh just thought it was weird Southern. But they do recognize each other by their dialect, which is one of the interesting things as they go forward for federal recognition. Their language is an important part of their identity, except that it's not a separate language. Mm-hmm. If they had an ancestral language at this day, they would have federal recognition in no time. But getting the government to understand their dialect is a distinct dialect of English. They didn't create it in a longhouse. It just came about as a natural cultural manifestation.
Well, and it maintains itself. And again, I mean, you think about the Outer Banks. That's a place that is geographically remote. It's hard to get to unless you're
serious about your vacation.
A determined dingbatter can get there, but the rest of us. So how is it that that's becoming endangered, whereas Lumbee, right in the middle of everything, remains distinct?
Well, it's because one, there are a lot of Lumbee, 45,000 to 50,000. And secondly, it's a very segregated place culturally, so that there are a number of schools that are still quite segregated, you know, elementary schools that are 95% Lumbee. And then thirdly, there's a sense of growing Indian identity, you know, and people don't go visit much, you know, so only a few people stray there off of Route 95.
Segregation is still an unfortunate artifact of our school systems all over the state, and so that also refers to African-American populations. Right. But there you're finding a divergence in dialect. Tell us about that.
Well, in African-American English, it used to be much more regionally accommodating of the dialect. So an older African-American who grew up on the Outer Banks would sound to someone from Raleigh like they were white. But because African-American speech has become so associated with youth identity as being African-American, and the whole notion of sort of talking white is sort of an oppositional identity. People don't want to talk white because that means they're not acting in a culturally appropriate behavior. So it's actually led to a divergence of African-American English today, so that younger speakers today are more different from neighboring dialects than their grandparents were a couple of generations ago.
And because most of our staff members have smartphones, we were able to download samples of those dialects to give us a sense of exactly what you're talking about. So here's a sample of someone from a much older generation.
We was young fellas and got to fighting. I hit him lick or two, and he run to the shelter to get an axe, and I knew what was in there when he went there, and a notion struck me: you better get behind the shelter.
Now, who is that? And
well, he's a gentleman who was born in 1910, lived all of his life in Hyde County, and is African American. Although, when we play that tape to listeners from here, 90% identify him as white.
His great great granddaughter is who we're going to hear
next. His
great granddaughter. Here she is.
They have told this story about now. If this woman be on the road thumbing, and you stop and you give her a ride, and then you think she asked in the car with you, and then when you turn over, she's not in the car with you. Somebody honestly seen that light before. It's me. I've never seen it because I don't be trying to worry about seeing nothing like that.
So here's a young woman who's also lived all of her life in the same house as her great-grandfather, and she is identified by people as 90%. 90% of the people identify her as African-American. So the question then is, what is taking place? And part of it is, an identity thing. And part of it is there's more accessibility to cities and so forth. And the norms for African-American youth in terms of speech tend to be more urban-oriented. So to her, that means Greenville and other places in North Carolina where there's more of an urban center.
So clearly this is such an important identity marker. And we're talking with Walt Wolfram, who's a professor at NC State, about his research documenting dialects in North Carolina. And, of course, in this context, these are characteristics that are interesting to us, delightful. But at universities and in the workplace, accents can be markers that cast their speakers in an unfavorable light. Two of Walt Wolfram's colleagues at NC State focused on that aspect of linguistic diversity. They worked with Walt to start a program called Educating the Educated. It promotes awareness of language and linguistic discrimination on campus. Stephanie Dunstan is an assistant director of assessment. Welcome, Stephanie. Good to have you here. And Audrey Jaeger is an associate professor of higher education. Hello, Audrey.
Hi.
Audrey, tell us about this program and what's involved here.
Well, the goal of Educating the Educated is multi-pronged in terms of when you think about language and what Walt has shared. We all have a dialect. We all have something in common, that is language and how we speak. So the program is to connect all aspects of the university to this common understanding of language. So when you think about a diversity program, you typically think about an intervention toward one population. And in this case, we're looking at faculty, staff, students, new, veteran, in all aspects, and bringing to them the awareness that language is part of a diversity conversation. Diversity is very common in higher education when we think about we want to create an inclusive community and we want students to feel comfortable and faculty and staff to feel comfortable. But that conversation up till now has not included language. It's broadened in terms of we started with race and gender, socioeconomic status, sexual orientation. But until NC State, until some of Stephanie's work, we hadn't been talking about diversity. So our goal is to hit all those multi-pronged approach individuals through looking at language and sharing that common component to say we really need to look at language as part of the diversity conversation.
And Stephanie, the idea for this emerged while you were doing your PhD dissertation, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Yes. So I came to the field of higher education research from sociolinguistics. I was a former student of Waltz. And I was really surprised at the lack of literature, or the lack of research in higher education about language as an element of diversity that students bring with them to campus. And so knowing how closely and intrinsically tied it is to culture and identity, I wanted to explore how language shapes students' experiences, especially when those students are a speaker of a dialect that might be socially stigmatized, and especially one that might be associated with, unfair stereotypes of being less educated or less intelligent. And so I chose to study a dialect group in North Carolina. So I interviewed students from rural southern Appalachia and their experiences at a large research institution in an urban center to try and get a sense of the role that it played, and found some really interesting things.
Such as?
Well, so my primary finding, I think one that's sort of overarching and has some of the most important implications for practice for us is this idea of code switching. So whether in an academic or social setting, the participants in my study felt that those who had a more vernacular dialect or who whose dialect contained more features that carried stigma and that were noticeable on campus indicated feeling this need to change the way that they speak. So in academic settings, that might mean being in a classroom feeling like they maybe shouldn't raise their hand to speak up in class without code switching to a more standardized dialect, because at some point either someone had laughed at them or they had seen a peer be laughed at in class for speaking out, or feeling that they needed to change their dialect to code switch when interacting with faculty or peers for a group project, for example, so that they wouldn't be perceived as less intelligent. They didn't have another barrier to overcome. And then in social settings, the idea of code switching comes up again. So in terms of how they interact with others and make friends, or, you know, one of my speakers, for example, mentions that she code switches in any situation, whether it's in the residence hall or at a party, if she thinks that she might become, quote, the entertainment.
Mm. Well, so Audrey, Stephanie talked about one of the ways in which you pick up on this. People are laughing at you. You see somebody laughing. What are some of the other ways that a student might pick up on the fact that this is that they're being discriminated against?
It's typically, and you often think about it in terms of gender, and a lot of the research talks about when a faculty member calls on someone, they'll call on the male before the female in the classroom. Students pick up on the same kind of thing. As soon as, particularly in a college classroom, you see students come in and everyone introduces themselves the first day of class, and that immediate reaction they have from their classmates and their faculty member shares with them how my dialect is appreciated or not appreciated and the assumptions that someone might care about that information. So what students will do is they'll just immediately react by not engaging in the classroom.
Now you would think these are universities where people, especially professors, maybe undergrads are not quite there yet, but they've been trained in critical thinking. They ought to know better, don't they, Stephanie? And what's going on? Why are they still doing this?
Well, to a large extent, these ideas of, language is an element of diversity, and this idea that all dialects and all languages are created equally. There's a funny quote that only before God and linguists are all languages considered equal. it really kind of flies in the face of what we've been taught most of our lives in educational settings that, in the U.S., like in many countries, there's this idea that there's a single standard dialect that we ought to speak, that we should aim for, and that you've just missed the target if your speech diverges from that, especially with writing. So there's also sometimes this conflation of writing and spoken word, that they're two ways of doing the same thing, but they're really two ways of doing two different things. So sometimes when we're really prescriptive about writing, we apply that same prescriptivism to the way that we speak. And so even well-meaning educators can sometimes, get caught up in these ideas that we have about standardness.
But Audrey, only God and the Academy would never consider discrimination. So how do you broach the subject and reveal this on campus? And then what's the method? How do you get things to change?
Well, the good thing about this is that as soon as people become aware, there's an instantaneous, somewhat sympathetic and wanting to know more. So faculty responses have been, I just didn't know, and I do it. And it hasn't been in some other, it's easy in other types of demographics where you say, well, that's not me, or I don't do that, or because I'm not a certain race, I don't feel that way. But language covers all. So faculty, students, and staff have been quite receptive. As soon as you engage in the conversation, they realize it's about them and about everyone else. So they're much more comfortable in the conversation. And faculty have been very open just to understanding their awareness. As soon as they understand what they're doing, they realize that changing that is part of who they need to be. And it also, they've expressed that it's happened to them. So they can be the most renowned scholar in a certain area, but when they present that to colleagues, they also code switch to make sure that their language is appropriate to whatever audience they're giving it to. So it's the part of, I recognize it in others, but I also recognize it in myself.
I can't tell you the number of faculty who are from here who have gone north and come back and sort of reported just offhand to me what they had to do when they went to Yale and Harvard to cover up. So, Walt, you've been in the business of collecting all this data and in the Academy yourself. I mean, is this something you noticed through your career at NC State?
Well, I've noticed the diversity, and we have a tendency to be an outreach program. So we have a program in the schools on dialects, and we take it to the community, and we give back to the communities. But it struck me that we aren't doing enough right on our own campus in terms of, we have the whole canon of diversity, and we know what those items are, but where is language? And so in a sense, we're realizing that we need to start with our own campus and with faculty. And also, we've talked about it at other universities, and they say, oh, exactly, we should do that on our campus. So we're trying to promote this by example and hope that every other university will promote it, because there's all kinds of diversity. Whatever state campus you're on, there are people from all over the state speaking all different dialects. So we have a language diversity video now, 5 or 6 minutes, where we feature this and we get the chancellor's support and key members and also talk to students about it too.
It is interesting that the language or the dialect we grow up hearing, we of course make the norm. That's pretty obvious. The fact that we'll make distinctions and say that everything else or many of the other dialects we hear are therefore inferior and a reflection of an inferior mind, when in fact it takes just as much ingenuity to craft those sentences as it does to craft yours. Mm-hmm. Right. So but it's not always, not every other dialect is inferior. I mean, I think we've come to understand that if one is speaking with a British accent here in the United States, we somehow defer to that.
And it doesn't even make any difference in the United States if it's a stigmatized or prestigious British dialect. It's British.
Cockney works just fine for us, right? Yeah. So do you have any guesses about what's going on there and how we make those associations?
Well, there's a whole social history and a political history, and actually it wasn't by accident that after the Civil War, not only did Southern English become more distinct, but became more stigmatized, So everything is rooted in this social and historical and cultural, asymmetries, and it applies to language as much as any other artifact of culture.
Stephanie, what's the cost? You talked about this coded language that people have to go through. On the one hand, it's an added ingenuity, right? I mean, I'm exercising even harder. But what are the costs of having to disguise your identity when you're in this context?
Right. So this is something that, and another reason why we think this this program is so important is because it can be really damaging to be in a position as a student or as a faculty member or staff member when you feel like something about your identity and your culture is not being valued. So for students, for example, you know, we talk a lot about in higher education research about different student populations that might be at risk for different reasons. So consider, for example, a first-generation college student. You're the first person in your family to ever attend college. So there might already be a sense of, you know, do I belong here? You're noticing things that, you know, you might be a little bit different. Add another layer there. Perhaps you're also a speaker of a regional dialect that carries some stigma and that marks you as an other on campus. And then when you start to feel that your speech is devalued, even if it's in a well-meaning way, you know, a faculty member or advisor suggests that, you know, you're very bright, but to be taken more seriously or to be considered a scholar, you know, you might want to consider accent reduction or something like this. Even though that's, you know, very well-meaning, the implicit message is there's something inferior about me, my dialect, my culture. And so when they feel, you know, devalued in that sense, it can create, you know, a disconnect and cause the student to disengage.
Make a tough job even tougher. Well, I want to thank you. It's a great project. Thank you for being on the program. Stephanie Dunstan and Audrey Jaeger helped co-found the NC State program Educating the Educated. Walt Wolfram is a professor of English at NC State who co-authored the book Talkin' Tar Heel, How Our Voices Tell the Story of North Carolina, along with Jeffrey Reaser. Thank you all for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up next, the politics of soccer in Latin America. Stay tuned.